Hi, this is Ruth McCauley returning with the second half hour of news from the Decatur area for Thursday, December 24th. We begin, as always, with some of the most recent listings of deaths here in the area. We begin with some Macon County announcements. David D. Hood, 58, of Arlington Heights, who was born December 14th, 1957, in Decatur, passed away suddenly on December 20th, 2015. Visitation will be held Sunday, December 7th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at Lauterberg and Oler Funeral Home, 2000 East Northwest Highway in Arlington Heights. Prayers will be said on Monday, December 28th at 9:15 a.m. at the funeral home, and then proceed to St. James Church, 831 North Arlington Heights Road in Arlington Heights, for funeral mass at 10 a.m. And interment will follow at All Saints Cemetery. For information, call 847-253-5423 or go to Lauterberg Oler, and that's all one word, LauterBurgOher.com. Everett J. Ev Inman, 92, of Decatur, passed away on Monday, December 21st, in his home with his family by his side. Services to celebrate Everett's life will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, December 28th, at the Elwyn United Methodist Church, 1260 West Elwyn Road in Elwyn, with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard to conclude the service. Visitation will be held for 2 hours prior to the services at the church. Memorial donations are suggested to the Elwyn United Methodist Church or the St. Teresa Education Foundation. Robert L. Lowe, age 84, of Amboy, passed away peacefully Tuesday, December 22nd, at Serenity Hospice and Home in Oregon. A celebration of Robert's life will be held on Monday, December 28th, at 11 a.m. in the Zion United Methodist Church in Mendota, with Pastor Hugon Kim officiating. Burial will follow in Woodside Cemetery in Lee Center, with military honors by the Amboy American Legion. Visitation will be held on Sunday, December 27th, from 2 until 6 p.m., with Masonic services at 5 p.m. in the Mim Jones Funeral Home in Amboy. Visitation will also be held on Monday from 10 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. in the church. Memorials have been established to Serenity Hospice, Zion United Methodist Church, and Midwest Mission Distribution Center. George T. Tom Rambo, 65, of Forsyth, passed away on Monday, December 21st, in his home. Graveside service to celebrate Tom's life will be held at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, December 29th, in Laplace Cemetery, with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday in Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. The family of Tom Rambo is being served by Moran and Goebel Funeral Home, honored provider of veterans funeral care at 2801 North Monroe Street in Decatur. Melody Erin Singleton, 35, of Decatur, died on November 25th in Barnes Hospital, St. Louis. Memorial services will be held on noon on Wednesday, February 24th in 1902 North Martin Luther King Drive. I'm not sure what building that is, but that's the address. Larry L. Weltmer, 75, of Mount Zion, passed away on Tuesday, December 22nd, at St. Mary's Hospital. A service to celebrate Larry's life will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, December 26th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Westwood Street Funeral Home. Visitation will be held from noon until the service time at 1. The family requests casual attire. He will be laid to rest next to his wife at Graceland Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Cancer Care Center at St. Mary's Hospital. Wendell Irvin Figgins, 63, of Springdale, Arkansas, formerly of Stewartson, Illinois, died on Tuesday, December 22nd. Memorial services will be held at 3 p.m. Sunday, December 27th, in the Stewartson Seventh-day Adventist Church, 206 West Main Street in Stewartson, Illinois. Visitation will be from 2 to 3 p.m. Sunday in the church. Burial will be at a later date in Lower Ash Grove Cemetery in Strasburg, Illinois. Memorials may be given to the Stewartson Seventh-day Adventist Church or to the family. Arrangements are being handled by Howe and Yawkey Funeral Home in Strasburg, Illinois. One funeral is listed as pending in the paper, and that's for Augusta Marie Tetley, 96, of Decatur, who died on Tuesday, December 22nd. Brentlinger and Earle Funeral Home in Decatur is in charge of the arrangements, and I'm sure they'll appear here in the Decatur Herald and Review when those have been finalized. We turn now to the opinion pages, and I'm just amazed, but they have printed as the editorial today an historic letter written by a little girl. Many of you have heard it before, but we're going to read it again. It's headlined, "Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus." The editor's note says, 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon wrote a letter, O'Hanlon, yeah, wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Sun, and the quick response by veteran newsman Francis Farsalas Church was printed as an unsigned editorial on September 21st, 1897. It is reprinted from museum.org. "Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus?" Virginia O'Hanlon. "Dear Virginia, your little friends were wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, and his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginians. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. the eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they're not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders there are, unseen and unseeable, in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world, which not the strongest man, not even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernatural beauty and glory behind. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus? Thank God, he lives and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood. Okay, we move on to a columnist on the page who carries the headline, Trump Gets Bigots Out From Hiding. A couple of weeks ago I wrote, let's not mince words, Donald Trump is a bigot and a racist. I cited a long list of incidents in which he targeted women, Latinos, African Americans, Muslims, Asians, and the disabled. Here's what I heard back from Trump's defenders. Let's not mince words, somebody tweeted under the name Helios Magistos. Milbank, that's the columnist, is an anti-white parasite and a bigoted kike supremacist. Various Trump defenders derided Muslims as Muzzies and Moslimes. They spoke of the sociopath Hussein, President Obama. But mostly they zeroed in on my Judaism, which they discovered from internet searches. You are a kike communist, one informed me. Another called my girlfriend, who has a common Jewish surname, a gross Jewess. One of the Trump defenders declared that I am loyal to a foreign state. He linked to a column I wrote about a Jewish ritual I undertook with my infant daughter. Wrote still another, Jews are 2% of the population, but 60% of the people calling whites racist. Once you notice it, you can't unsee it. The Twitterverse and social media generally can be dark places, as can the comments section of the Washington Post articles and my email inbox. This is the 7th presidential campaign I've covered in some form over 25 years, and harsh criticism comes with the territory. But the Trump backers' venom is without precedent. His supporters surely aren't all bigots, but he is bringing the bigoted in from the cold. There is an obvious truth to what white national publisher Jared Taylor told the New Yorker this summer. Trump's, quote, support comes from people who are more like me than he might like to admit, end quote. I write this not out of any hope of changing the minds of Trump backers, nor to reinforce the prevailing view among liberals that Trump has unleashed ugliness. I write this to conservatives of conscience. Is this what you want conservatism, the Republican Party, and America to be? My post colleagues, Carol Leonig and David Nakamura, and others have documented the racial violence at Trump rallies, including the video of Trump's personal bodyguard punching an immigration demonstrator in the head. And where is the condemnation of this behavior? In last week's Las Vegas debate, Trump's rivals all but ignored the front runner, who previously said of a black protester at his event, "Maybe you should have been roughed up." Trump is burning down the Republican House and the American House, yet his rivals are on a march of the narcissists. If Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, John Kasich, and other sensible candidates were to unite behind any one of them, that person would likely beat Trump and Ted Cruz. Instead, enabled by new campaign finance rules that keep even weak candidates flush, they fight only for themselves. It's easy to mock the Trump backers. They write, "You're a damn liar," and complain that I use the words bigot and racist. Of more concern are their allegations that because I've condemned Trump, I'm an Israel first believer with a 1-inch deep loyalty to America, that I'm a mentally ill, anti-white pariah and American traitor, and that as a Jew, I think Christians are to be destroyed as idolaters, and that Jews want to wipe out the Christians and get control of their gold. Is this what Republican stands for? Is this conservatism? Our next columnist writes, "Don't close schools for terrorist threats." What if the Los Angeles public schools get another email promising a terrorist attack on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday? If you close the schools the first time, what do you do the next time? If I were a lazy terrorist with no guns, bombs, or desire for martyrdom, I'd be keeping up a steady stream of blood-curdling forecasts to the school authorities in Los Angeles and every other major city in America. Well, maybe not New York. The people in charge there, after getting the same threat, read it, deleted it, and proceeded with the business of educating kids. Los Angeles, however, decided to take no chances, forcing 640,000 kids to stay home. It was an understandable choice. I was not going to let something happen on my watch, said Superintendent Ramon Cortinas the next day. My priority yesterday was our children, our staff, and our property. New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton took a different view. I think it was a significant overreaction, he said. And Mayor Bill de Blasio dismissed the email as outlandish. They were willing to act on their best judgment and put their careers on the line rather than surrender to efforts to create mass panic and disruption. Parents generally seem to have supported the Los Angeles closure, despite the inconvenience. One father also told the New York Times that henceforth he will drive his 10-year-old daughter to school. "The bus, it's a soft target," he said. "There's no safety on the bus." True, but there's no safety in his car either. A couple of fanatics who could attack a school bus with bombs and guns could do the same with other vehicles pulling up to drop off kids. They could do the same thing on the playground, in the cafeteria, or in classrooms. About 99% of the world is soft targets. Very few places are beyond the reach of those plotting bloody mayhem. Short of stationing the National Guard on every campus, schools are vulnerable, just like shopping malls, supermarkets, restaurants, and soccer fields. But nearly every place also happens to be amazingly safe. Since 9/11, the think tank New America reports 45 people have died in jihadi attacks on U.S. soil, about as many as were killed by dogs last year alone. The latter in your garage is more to be feared than the Islamic State. In their new book, Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, scholars John Mueller and Mark Stewart calculate the average American's chance of dying at the hands of terrorists in a given year is 1 in 4 million. Your chance of dying in a car wreck is more than 100 times greater. That guy driving his daughter to school is ignoring the bigger hazard. Since 9/11, we have spent more than $1 trillion on domestic homeland security, note Mueller and Stewart. But the share of people who expect another terrorist attack causing large numbers of Americans to be lost has remained around 70% since 9/11. This sum doesn't count all the money we spent in Iraq acting on George W. Bush's theory, we will fight them over there so we do not have to face them in the United States of America. The Islamic State didn't take that offer. The Iraq War spawned new enemies, so in reality, maybe we are justified in feeling no safer now than 14 years ago. Even so, the danger is much less than commonly assumed. Critics lament the obsession with terrorism in Tuesday's Republican debate, but politicians wouldn't pander to popular distress if it weren't already there. Gnawing anxiety has become part of our collective psyche. Any new act of terrorism confirms our worries and makes us yearn for invulnerability. But succumbing to fear is exactly what our enemies want us to do. The Islamic State legions have only faint hopes of carrying out attacks on American children. But if malefactors can shut schools down by merely sending messages, they don't need to. They can impose a heavy burden on us at little expense or risk to themselves. Officials in Los Angeles may have figured out by now they can't be so quick to keep students at home, otherwise there will be no end to the threats. Authorities elsewhere have already taken heed. San Francisco schools opened Thursday despite a threat received Wednesday evening. When two Dallas schools got an ominous email, Mayor Mike Rawlings said, "Someone is trying to scare Dallas, and that's not going to work." Somewhere, a terrorist wannabe was disappointed. The children of Dallas were fine. And we have a letter to the editor of the Decatur Herald and Review, signed by Donald Gruber of Clinton. Teachers ID troubled students at own peril. A letter published here in late October posited the idea that because of their unique position with regard to children, teachers could be vital in spotting behaviors of their students that could identify possible problems before they evolve into more serious issues. Here's why. From kindergarten onward, children manifest signs of emotional and psychological strengths or weaknesses through their social or antisocial behaviors. Teachers become sensitive to the behavioral traits of their students and pick up aberrant signals early. This is a noble idea indeed, but based on personal experience, there appears to be an unwritten policy of denial rampant in schools. Teachers who report observations of aberrant student behaviors to school officials run the very real risk of focusing negative attention upon themselves. Educational administrators tend to focus on keeping the waters calm. Those bringing such concerns to the administration soon learn that those making waves are considered troublemakers and are subsequently rebuked, castigated, threatened, reprimanded, followed by the loss of support. Reporting aberrant behavior of children can be a dangerous endeavor for teachers interested in maintaining a satisfactory working relationship with school administration, who are mostly focused on promoting their own careers and seem to have little regard for student, classroom, or teacher welfare. The basic message is shut up about it, because effective administrators solve all problems. In other words, don't ruin my empty facade as an effective administrator. So, yes, it is a good idea for teachers to be a first line of reporting for troubled students who may grow into troubled adults without some intervention early. But until there is a change in the way self-serving school administrators approach this subject, these observations will go unreported, and the behaviors can morph into problems that may eventually and seriously affect society. A letter to the editor, signed by Donald Gruber of Clinton. I'm going to read some of the brief items that appear in the local section today of the Decatur Herald and Review. Man dies in crash. A fatal car crash near Salem is under investigation by Illinois State Police. Michael G. Becker, 46, of Salem, was southbound on Illinois 37 at 8:57 p.m. Tuesday in his pickup when he left the roadway into a steep ditch. The truck became airborne, and when it landed, hit another steep ditch, rolled out of the ditch into the southbound lane, and came to a stop. Becker was transported to Salem Township Hospital, where he died. Water main repair. East Grove Road between Phillips Drive and Forest Green Drive will be closed until about 3 p.m. Wednesday, December 30th. Okay, you've got a warning here. Doesn't say when it will close, but I'm assuming early morning. Well, again, East Grove Road between Phillips Drive and Forest Green Drive will be closed until about 3 p.m. on Wednesday, December 30th, to allow city crews to repair water main. Not a valid ID. Illinois officials say a state driver's license won't be enough identification to get into most federal facilities after January 10th, when the state's exemption from federal real ID requirements ends. It also could eventually mean the Illinois driver's licenses won't be accepted as identification for commercial airplane flights. The Chicago Tribune reports the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has notified Illinois that its request for an extension has been denied. Illinois previously was granted 2 1-year extensions. The 2005 Real ID Act imposes tougher requirements for proof of legal U.S. residency in order for state driver's license to be valid for federal purposes. Missouri also has been deemed non-compliant. And from Springfield, Rauner takes clemency action. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner has granted clemency to 7 people and denied another 247 requests. In a statement Wednesday, Rauner's office said each person who received clemency has been subject to a recent criminal background check. They receive pardons with expungement, allowing them to ask a court to remove their convictions from their records. The grantees include 2 people who were convicted of burglary, including one case from 1978. The others were convicted of theft, forgery, reckless driving, and methamphetamine conspiracy. Rauner's office says a backlog of about 1,000 petitions remains from previous administrations. They say the 254 petitions he took action on Wednesday date back to October 2010. It's the 6th time the Republican has acted on clemency petitions since taking office in January. Sounds like he's working his way through the list. Okay, I'm out of time. This has been Ruth McCauley reading news from the Decatur area, all from the Decatur Herald and Review. Sorry, no Tribune today. For December 24th, Thursday, the day before Christmas. I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah and a great holiday season. Hope to be back with you next week. Take care.